From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Hairspray, the new musical based on John Waters' 1988 film, opens on Broadway next week. It's an homage to the teased hair and fad dances of the 1960s. On today's Fresh Air, we feature interviews with John Waters and the late Divine, who starred in Hairspray, as well as Waters' underground classics Pink Flamingos and Polyester. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews Clint Eastwood's new movie, Bloodwork. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. U.S. Customs Service officials announced today the arrest of 20 people involved in a major child pornography ring. 10 of those arrested were Americans. Customs Commissioner Robert Bonner says 45 children were victimized when their parents sexually molested them, then sent pornographic pictures of their children across the internet.
These 45 children who suffered abuse at the hands of those charged in this case will continue to suffer, because these images will be on the internet for years and years to come, passed from pedophile to pedophile.
One of the Americans who was arrested has already pleaded guilty and been sentenced to 20 years in prison. President Bush says he's got no timetable for deciding whether to order a military strike on Iraq. During a brief interview at his Texas ranch, the president also said he may not decide on any action this year. Leaders of the Iraqi opposition, meanwhile, have agreed to hold a conference to build opposition to President Saddam Hussein. They announced the decision after a meeting of opposition leaders with U.S. officials at the State Department. NPR's Mary Louise Kelly reports.
Representatives of Iraq's six main opposition groups met with State and Defense Department officials for about 2 hours. Both sides emerged calling the talks constructive. Hamid al-Bayati of the Iran-based Supreme Council of Islamic Revolution said opposition leaders will look next to a larger, more inclusive gathering.
We have agreed to convene a meeting of the Iraqi opposition in consultation with all opposition elements, ensuring sufficient representation for all the Iraqi people that are opposed to dictatorship.
Al-Bayati, who spoke on behalf of all the opposition leaders, said U.S. officials showed more seriousness than in past conversations about overthrowing Saddam Hussein. Mary Louise Kelly, NPR News, Washington.
Air Force investigators have recovered two military laptop computers that have been missing since August 1st. The computers were taken from the U.S. Central Command headquarters near Tampa, Florida. NPR's Philip Davis reports.
Air Force officials recovered the laptop computers from a private residence near the base. A man, whose name and affiliation have not yet been released, is now in military custody. According to Major Mike Richman of the Air Force's Office of Special Investigations, the man, who had access to the computers, apparently confessed to investigators. Richman said it appears the theft was not related to national security or plans for a possible attack on Iraq. Only one of the laptops apparently had any classified information, and it's currently being checked to make sure that information has not been compromised. U.S. Central Command is headquartered at MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa and oversees military operations in the Middle East, including Iraq. Philip Davis, NPR News, Miami.
On Wall Street, the Dow closed up 33 points. This is NPR News. More than 450,000 of the retro-style PT Cruiser cars are being recalled. Daimler Chrysler announced the recall today. A problem with the car's fuel pump was discovered during government safety tests. Company officials say the problem will be fixed by adding a secondary seal on top of the fuel pump module. After reporting losses for the past 2 years, tire maker Bridgestone Firestone has announced it will finally be posting a profit. Jacqueline Fellows of member station WPLN has more.
Company officials announced the news on the two-year anniversary of their massive tire recall. Problems with tread separation on Ford Explorers tarnished the company's image so much that many thought they'd never recover. Sales and profits are up, but the company continues to post a $14 million loss for the first half of this year. Still, that's a dramatic improvement over the nearly half a billion dollar loss Bridgestone Firestone posted during the same time last year. Vice President Michael Gorey says the company's return to financial profitability is ahead of schedule.
I would say by the end of August, we will be in the black. We're almost there at the end of July, but by the end of August, we'll be in black.
Gorey says operating efficiencies and a company-wide reorganization spurred the turnaround. For NPR News, I'm Jacqueline Fellows in Nashville.
Former Georgia Governor Lester Maddox is in intensive care at an Atlanta hospital today. He's suffering from a number of ailments, including cancer and heart disease, and has undergone two recent surgeries. His daughter says he does remain alert. Maddox was governor of Georgia from 1967 to 1971. He gained national notoriety after chasing blacks away from his Atlanta restaurant in the 1960s. I'm Dale Willman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross.
Tracy, I have told you about that hair, all ratted up like a teenage Jezebel.
Oh, Mother, you're so 50s.
Tracy's flamboyant flip is all the rage, Miss Edna. Jackie Kennedy, our first lady, even rats her hair.
But Tracy ain't no first lady, are you, Tracy? No siree. She's a hair hopper. That's what she is. Now, I've got nothing but hampers of ironing to do, and my diet pill is wearing off.
Hairspray, the new Broadway musical based on the 1988 John Waters film, opens next week. On today's show, we'll listen back to interviews that Terry recorded with John Waters and the late actor Divine, who starred in Hairspray and all of Waters' prior films. John Waters first became known for films that were shocking and hilarious in their bad taste. His 1972 film Pink Flamingos helped create the midnight movie phenomenon. His other films include Polyester, Serial Mom, Pecker, and Cecil B. Demented. Hairspray is an homage to the teased hair and fad dances of the early 60s. The film stars Ricky Lake as Tracy Turnblad, an overweight teenager who upstages the reigning teen queen on the local TV dance show. Terry asked John Waters if the Corny Collins dance program in his movie was supposed to be a takeoff of Baltimore's Buddy Dean show.
I watched all the teen dance shows, and so it's all of them sort of put together and pushed one step a little further. But it's not that exaggerated, basically. The kids really did look like that then. The hairdos, all that was part of it. It wasn't a rebel look. Your mother had that hairdo, too.
I think a lot of us learned what it would be like to be a teenager by watching the dance shows. Did you watch the dance shows
all that? Sure, you learned how to be a teenager from it. I mean, and there were so many gimmick dances that you had to, they only lasted about a week in popularity. There were so many of them. So you had to watch these shows. It was like homework for the weekend because everybody do those dances. And if you didn't know how to do them that weekend, you didn't have time because there was already a new one out.
You have every record and more that I can remember, the novelty records. You have the Continental, the Fly.
The Bug, the Roach. The Shake a Tail Feather, the Madison. And they're all real dances.
Well, I figured, first of all, why did you include so many of the novelty dances in the movie?
Well, because I love them, and I wanted to bring them back. I wanted the fact that that was sort of a forgotten period when every dance was a gimmick dance. So I had all those records. They were my favorite records. I used to get them out late at night and after a few drinks and put them on.
And dance.
Sometimes even dance. So I picked those songs first and sort of wrote the movie around them, that I wanted to include them.
Did you have to work hard to find a choreographer who knew these dances and could actually teach them to the teenagers that you cast in the movie?
They auditioned 80s dances because we couldn't expect them to, okay, come in and do the New Continental. How would they possibly know it? And we got the ones that could dance the best. And then when we had the first rehearsal for 60s dances, it was so frightening because they couldn't do any of them. They had to relearn how to dance because it's a completely different way. So how it worked was there was a woman, Linda Snyder, who was one of the queens of the Buddy Dean show, and I knew her. And she came and taught the kids the basic steps of the dance. Then Ed Love, the choreographer, who grew up in Philadelphia, came and made them better and really choreographed them. So that's how it became. And Ed, I made a tape. Linda just did a tape of just doing the generic steps of each one of the dances. And then he built on that.
The main character in your movie, the main teenager,
right,
is a girl who's very fat.
Yeah.
And I thought it was perfect for one of your movies, that you should make, like, the heroine a really heavy girl.
Sure, because, I mean, she's the ultimate underdog, and all my films are about underdogs. She wins, she gets the guy, she gets on the show, she has a happy ending. She's great. You know, I auditioned probably every fat actress teenager in America. I saw lots and lots of them. And a casting woman in New York found her for me. And it was depressing because some of the girls would come in and I'd have to say, you're not fat enough. And one started crying because she had spent 2 years to lose weight because every director said she was too heavy.
Everybody in your movies, as you say, is usually really, they're outcasts and they're frequently somewhere between odd and bizarre looking.
Yeah.
What was your look when you were a teenager?
I went through different looks. At one period, I was preppy because that's how I grew up. But then I had bleached hair on the front. And I used to wear, then I wanted to be a beatnik. It was hard to be a beatnik in suburban Baltimore. But I wanted to be one, and I read all the books about them and everything, read Life magazine about beatniks, and I just really wanted to be one. That's why I have the whole scene with the whole beatnik scene in the movie.
Well, there's a great scene where Tracy and her boyfriend go into, they're looking for a place to hide out, basically.
Right.
They knock on a door. Everybody's turning them away, but these two beatniks on the door that they knock on let them in, and the beatniks are Rick Ocasek and Pia Zadora.
Right.
And it's this great like beatnik scene in their pad, and it's a wonderful, the scene is a wonderful confrontation between the bouffant hairdo ethic and the beatnik long black straight hair ethic.
The ironed hair. Which is not an exaggeration. Around 62 in Baltimore, all the girls had those big hairdos. And then suddenly, a few of the really hip ones started doing their hair straight, and people panicked. And it was called Going Joe, meaning Joe College. And people would say, I don't know, should I be Joe? I can't decide. I don't know what to do. It was a major thing. And what happened then is the kids that did do the ironed hair eventually became hippies. And the ones with the teased hair got married and became probably very middle class.
You look like a hair hopper to me. I mean, your hair is really uncool.
How do you get your hair so straight and so flat?
With an iron, man. I play my bongos, listen to Odetta, and then I iron my hair, dig?
I think we better get going now. The coast looks clear.
Let's do some reefer. We'll get high and I'll iron the chick's hair.
Reefer?
Drugs?
Loco weed. When I'm high, I am Odetta.
In the movie, you call women with really large hairdos hair hoppers.
Yeah.
Is that a Baltimore
expression?
That's
a Baltimore expression.
Yeah, it's a great expression.
Yeah.
I never
men can be hair hoppers, too.
A male hair hopper
is, you know, greased back and the continental look, it was called, with sport coats with a belt in the back and pointy toe shoes and that look. A hair hopper, basically, is someone that grew up without a lot of money, suddenly gets some, spends it wrongly, thinks they have style and don't.
Did you use real hairspray in the movie? In the opening scene, everybody's like spraying their hair.
It's real hairspray.
The boys.
Yeah, we used roughly 60 cases of hairspray in the movie, and because there's 1,100 extras. And when you worked on this movie, you had to go. It was like going into the fashion army. The boys had to go on one trailer to get their hair cut, then go to the next thing and get their hair slicked back. The girls had to go in, get it teased. We had like Chris Mason, who did all the hairdo, but then we had backups, people that would tease it. Then she'd come in and style it. You had to go through an assembly line. So a lot of the kids that were in it finally got so sick of combing it out that they would just leave it in and they would just go out in Baltimore with those ridiculous hairdos and just figure, too bad. You know, I can't go through this hairdo torture another day. Let's just leave it in.
Your movie set in 1962.
Yeah.
This is currently a period when there's actually a lot of nostalgia for 1962?
No, there's a lot of nostalgia for the 60s, but 62 is almost the 50s. There were no hippies. There were no drugs. Kennedy hadn't even been shot. It was right before everything changed.
That's why you chose that year?
Yeah. And so when people talk about the 60s, they talk about girls dancing in cages with fringe or hippies or the student rebellion or all that. This was way before any of that.
Do you hate nostalgia?
Well, obviously I had nostalgia about this movie. This is a memory movie. I'm sick of 60s nostalgia. I've been to clubs in New York where it's just like the Fillmore East, and I thought, I hated that then. Do I have to go through it another time? Oh, please, no. Not tie-dye again.
One of the big storylines in Hairspray is about the integration of this dance show.
Right.
And because it's a white-only show, except they have Negro Day once a month.
Which they did. That's not an exaggeration.
In the show you watched
in
Baltimore?
Yes. And they had them on other shows, too. And basically, I felt that to ignore that fact would have been really inauthentic. I don't know, is that the correct word? But if Hollywood had made this movie, they would have had blacks on the show and just ignored the fact that none of the shows, Bandstand didn't have blacks on it either. None of them did then. And basically the problem was that all the music was black, all the dancing came from blacks, black singers were on the show all the time as entertainers, but they couldn't dance. And it wasn't because the kids didn't want it, their parents didn't want it.
One of the things I really loved in the movie is that the worst insult that one girl can say about another is, she's a whore.
Well, they used to, didn't they, when I went to high school, they always used to say this, that girl's a whore.
Except it was, that girl's a hooah.
Yeah, right. And, you know, the girls that they said that about never were.
Oh, of course. I mean, how many girls in my high school were really whores?
I know. I mean, they were charging money. There weren't too many of that. But they never even slept with anybody. But if you got the reputation as a whore, it lasted. And they always used to say that, whisper, oh, that girl, she's a whore. You know, it was always, at least when I went to junior high, that was a very big insult.
Did you always want to know, like, what the real story was behind that?
I always hung around with the ones that they thought were the whores, actually.
John Waters recorded in 1988. A new musical based on his film Hairspray opens next week on Broadway. Coming up, an interview with the star of many John Waters movies, the late actor Divine. This is Fresh Air. Up until his death in 1988, Divine starred in every one of John Waters' movies, usually in the role of a woman. It was the cult classic Pink Flamingos that made Divine famous. If you've seen the film or the publicity stills, then you'll remember the image of Divine's huge frame covered in a skin-tight, low-cut gown. Divine also worked with other directors and considered himself to be a character actor, playing a male gangster in Alan Rudolph's Trouble in Mind, and Tab Hunter's love interest in the Western spoof Lust in the Dust. At the time of his death, Divine was scheduled to have a recurring role in the television sitcom Married with Children. In Hairspray, Divine had two roles, the villainous TV station owner Arvin Hodgepile and the overworked housewife Edna Turnblad. In this scene, Edna is taking her daughter Tracy shopping. They go to Mr. Pinky's hefty hideaway house of fashion for the ample woman to pick out some new clothes for Tracy to wear on the local TV dance show.
Mr. Pinky, I'm Tracy's business manager, Edna Turnblad.
Well, it's a pleasure to meet the both of you. Here we cater to the big bone gals like yourself who are stylish and at the same time frustrated by the lack of sizes in the department stores today. I saw you on TV. I want you to be my model.
Would she be paid for this?
One free outfit a month. You start tomorrow. I hope there's no diets in the works because I want to design your Miss Otto Show coronation gown myself.
Could you throw in a pair of complimentary petty pants in the deal?
You drive a hard bargain, Miss Edna, and rightfully so. Petty pants, panty girdle, you just let Tracy take her pick.
It's a deal. Thank you, Mr. Pinky.
I'm going to make you a star.
Let's talk about your roles in Hairspray. You really make a very sympathetic, beleaguered housewife. You know, really, you play the role with such empathy for the part. Did you know a lot of women like that? You know, women who were too busy to do anything because there was still ironing to do.
Oh, well, I didn't know any of them personally. My mother certainly wasn't like that. I mean, if there was a party, the ironing would have to wait. But not that she wasn't a good mother and a good wife, but she's a good time girl, too. But and there are women out there. I would see them, friends, mothers, and in different situations. So sure, they're out there, a lot of them.
A part of the movie is about hairdos, about the great teased bouffant hairdos of the early 60s. And I know John Waters is really enamored with those old hairdos. You used to be a hairdresser, didn't you?
Well, for a very short time. I'm glad I had that experience. It's come in very helpful now. Because when I'm on the road and things during my club act, there aren't always hairdressers available or things, so I end up having to do it myself. And I said, I'm glad I know how to tease, because that's definitely the look they want. But I said to John, he doesn't have to go too far from his front door, actually, to still see women that look just like that. When I was doing the film, it was very funny, because the first day on the set, I walked down the street. No one looked at me twice. I walked right through the camera crew, past John, and kept going, and none of them looked at me. I came back and stood right in front of John. He looked at me and he did a double take. It was very funny. He said, I can't believe it. That's perfect. So I looked just like one of the girls on the street.
How did that make you feel?
Oh, it was good. I mean, that was the best compliment. I mean, I did fit right in. I did look exactly the way I was supposed to. And because so often with my size and things, I'm so, what's the word? You know, not uptight, but about sticking out too much.
Self-conscious?
You know? Yeah, self-conscious. Yeah, about sticking out too much and being the largest person on the set. But then in a way, that's the best thing to do, I guess. You get noticed more.
Let's talk about the male part that you played, and this is a kind of bad guy type part, a kind of villain part. He's the head of the TV studio who, you know, doesn't want to stand for integration. Now, John Waters told me you got fitted for new teeth for this role.
Yeah, well, they wanted me to look completely different, which is the great part of being a character actor, to look like the characters and to look different from yourself. That's why I said I never cared about looking always glamorous as a woman, which I always thought set me aside from being a drag queen or whatever, because I certainly looked anything but glamorous as Edna, with the long stringy oily hair. So in the same way, when they fitted me for teeth, big bucked teeth that had decay and things on them, then I had brown, because I have blue eyes. They poked me in the eye every morning for about 15 times trying to get these brown contacts in my eyes. And then I wore a toupee, which is the kind of hairstyle that men that are balding and they sweep it up from the bottom and over the top, mm-hmm. which really doesn't cover anything up, but they think it does in their own mind. And you can see the skin in between the hair, you know, a real dark brown because they usually dye their hair. So it was quite hideous, and with a little blue cord suit or whatever and suspenders. And
it's great you had to put on as much makeup to do this male part as you did to do the
female
part.
No, it was more. It took longer. I used to pray to be Edna again. There were a couple of days when I had to be both, and I was running around with Edna's wig on and great big teeth sticking out of my mouth. I'd say, wait a minute, give us those teeth. Because you got, you know, after a while, you jump out of one into the other so fast, you forget to take half the costume off.
You know, it's funny, whenever you play the man, it seems to be the heavy that you're playing. Even in John Waters' film Female Trouble, in which you play a man and a woman, the man's, you know, a real kind of tough guy, bad guy type. In Trouble in Mind, you played a gangster.
Yeah, I think I'm stuck with playing just hideous people, you know, except for like Edna. She was like I said, sweet, kind.
You know, you got started acting working with John Waters, and basically you were both still in school when you started. You were working with what, Super 8 film?
Oh yeah.
Shooting on the streets of Baltimore. It's not like you had come out of, you know, Yale School of Drama or something like that. You had this, you had this great theatrical background that you were going to draw on for your character roles. Did you ever decide once you really got into acting that you wanted to go to acting school? Did you ever feel like you needed that or that would help you in any way?
Well, sure, I thought about all of those things, but whenever I did talk to anyone about it, they said, "No, you have a natural talent. You have a natural ability to make people laugh. You have wonderful comic timing." I'm sounding like I'm sitting here blowing my own horn, but these are things that they told me. And I went to some very reputable acting coaches and people, and they didn't want to take me on. And they said, if something works, you know, don't fix it. Just go with it. And you just got to have the confidence and things to believe in yourself and to keep doing it, and you'll do it. So that's what I've done.
Did you love movies when you were growing up? What were some of your favorite films?
Oh, I've always had a very macho taste in movies. my favorites then when I was a kid were those Knights of the Round Table movies and war movies. And,
really?
Yeah. I still like a good war movie. I mean, Platoon and all those movies I loved. And I really do like Rambo movies and Sylvester Stallone. And Charles Bronson, I think, is probably my favorite.
So you probably really enjoy playing heavies when you get the chance to do that.
Yeah. I like to play in some of those movies, you know, where they kill 150 people in the first 2 minutes of film. It really does relieve, you know, any frustrations you might have, I think.
So you liked really war movies and action films. Did you like glamour movies when you were growing up?
Well, anything that Elizabeth Taylor was in, I liked.
Did you like her better when she was thin or heavy?
It didn't matter to me.
Uh-huh.
Didn't matter. I thought it was just more of her to look at when she got heavy. But still very beautiful. And I finally did meet her one day, and I couldn't speak at all. After years of planning what I was going to say to her, I was... Blah, 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 blah. So I don't drink, but I went and had a double scotch and came back and had a little conversation with her.
Did she know you?
She knew of me. It was a party for her daughter, Maria, and her hairdresser and makeup man, a man, were people that I've used. And And they had told her all about me, so she wanted to meet me at the party.
That's great that you'd use the same makeup man.
Yeah. We look a lot alike.
You know, John Waters has said that he really has always loved it when people who don't fit mainstream good looks take what they have and really turn it into style, turn it into, you know, an advantage. Did you feel like you were doing that when you were growing up? Because you were, I think you were always pretty heavy.
Yeah, well, no, actually not, because I was very much an introvert, and I never really went out of the house till I was about 16 years old. I was very uptight about my weight and about the way I looked, and always wanted to look like everyone else. And finally, my junior year, like when I was 16 and in high school, is when I really started hanging out with John and everyone else, that I got the confidence together to go out. And I was always in a coat. I always had a raincoat on or something. People probably thought I was a flasher, but I was just uptight about, you know, how fat I was. But at the same time, couldn't or wouldn't do anything about it. Finally, I went on a diet, like I said, my junior year, and lost to 80 pounds and went down to 145 and for my senior year. And then I was able to get dates and go to the prom and everything. But still, it was strange to me, because all of a sudden people talked to me. They wouldn't talk to me when I was fat. And I thought, well, what's this all about? You know, it was a rude awakening, actually, at a very young age.
So it must have been really liberating in a way when you started playing these extravagant roles where your weight was really a part of the role, and you were very theatrical about your size and theatrical about the way you dressed.
Oh, yeah. Well, John did help me, I mean, to gain a lot of self-confidence and to be proud and not to fit the mold that I think they really do try to put you on, especially here in America, that you've got to be thin, you've got to be, you know, under 200 pounds. And I mean, you don't. I mean, there are a lot of big people out there that are still very beautiful people, you know. As long as you're clean and neat, this is fine, you know.
The late actor Divine, speaking with Terry Gross in 1988. The new musical Hairspray opens on Broadway next week. We'll hear more from Divine and John Waters in the second half of our show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Saving Your Brain, the revolutionary plan to boost brain power, improve memory, and protect yourself against aging and Alzheimer's by Jeff Victoroff, MD. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's Madison time. Hit it.
Coming up, more with filmmaker John Waters and the late actor Divine, who starred in many of his films. And David Edelstein reviews Clint Eastwood's new movie, Bloodwork, based on the Michael Connelly book.
With a big strong turn and back to the medicine. Hit time. You're looking good. Now when I say hit it, I want you to go two up and two back, double cross, come out of it with the rifleman. Hit time. Now when I say hit it, I want the big strong M, erase it and back to the mat. Hit it. Walk on, you're looking good. tea time. Hit it.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. The new Broadway musical Hairspray opens next week. It's based on the film by John Waters. Let's continue now Terry's 1988 interview with the late actor Divine, who starred in Hairspray and all of Waters' movies until his death shortly after Hairspray premiered.
I think when you and Waters started working together, you had a lot of exploits, both in the kinds of movies that you did and in the kind of parties that you gave, and shoplifting, from what I've read. But it seems to me like you were part of this, very kind of avant-garde theatrical type of, into a theatrical kind of juvenile delinquency, as opposed to being like the real hoods.
Oh, yeah, we weren't really bad, you know. I think we were just bored, and we were young teenagers from your upper middle class families with nothing to do. I mean, I think the movies actually grew out of that situation also.
Mm-hmm.
But when we were making movies, we were locking each other in the trunks of our convertible cars and letting our friends out at the drive-in movies. And we'd drink a beer every now and then, which was, I guess, could be one of the worst things we ever did. We were never into any heavy drug scenes or into anything really, like I said, really bad that we would have to go to jail for, except a few bits of shoplifting. But I mean, all the kids did it, and so it was, I guess, a bit of peer pressure there about that, you know. But that was curbed too. I mean, it wasn't an everyday occurrence, and basically we were good kids.
How did the tough guys in the school treat you, the people who really were the hoods?
Oh, well, they used to wait for me every day to beat me up after school. And to the point where I was quite black and blue and afraid to say anything because it had threatened my life. And it was very bad. And finally, one day, I had to go for a physical to the doctor. And when I disrobed, I mean, it was quite obvious that something terrible was happening to me. And finally, I broke down after a lot of questioning and told him what the problem was. And they called my parents, and when they saw what I looked like, they were quite hysterical. And we had the police at the school, and the kids were expelled, and it was quite an ugly situation, which made me even more unpopular with their friends and the other people, you know. But so I had to go through, like I said, the next 2 years of school with that stigma attached to me. But then I think finally, like I said, in my senior year, it was more or less all right. It wasn't so bad. But up until then, it was quite hideous, and I really hated school, and I hated the whole situation.
Have you ever gotten the chance to see any of those guys who beat you up since you've become a famous actor?
I have. I've seen them in theaters that I've played.
Have you really?
Yeah, and different situations, and I don't think they actually knew who I was.
Oh, that's too bad. You.
I knew that I had, in a way, had the last laugh. It did make me feel good, because I'm never the type of person to seek revenge and things, but they said they did really mess my mind up for a while, and my teenage years, you know, which were supposed to be the best years of your life.
Now, you said that it was John Waters who gave, you know, who helped give you your image.
Right.
How did you decide on what that image was going to be when you first were getting
it together? Well, at the time, there were Andy Warhol, and a lot of people were making cult movies, and as they called them, underground films then, which were just the equivalent of your independently made movies today, low budget. And so the one name, like Viva, was very popular, so John gave me the name Divine. He just said he thought I was, and it was that I was funny, and that I was divine, and it was a good name for me. And also because we had a very heavy Catholic upbringing, we had sort of religious names. So I don't know, of course the names became more popular again today with Madonna and Cher and Prince and Princess and all of these people. But did I go off the subject?
No. And then when you were getting like this, excuse me?
I couldn't remember what the question was.
About forming the image when.
Yeah, so the thing with John wanted a very large woman because, as you had said before, he wanted the exact opposite of what normally would be beautiful. He wanted a 300-pound beauty as opposed to a 110-pound beauty. He wanted, as I've been called, an inflated Jane Mansfield. So that's what he got. And also, it's ironic that he would say the most beautiful woman in the world turns out to be a man. So everything there is backwards. So it's really a John Waters character. But then Van Smith, a very good friend of ours, who does all of John's movies, he does the makeup and costuming, and has done all, helped create the look for the character. He's the one that said, go in the bathroom, shave your head halfway back, and pluck all your eyebrows out. So, I mean, you really got to trust people. I went in the bathroom and did this. Came out, and I thought, what have I done now? But then he did my face almost like he always called it beauty gone berserk. And it was similar to kabuki-type makeup.
Oh, that's true, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, the work that he does is quite beautiful. And also, we didn't want to look like a normal, everyday woman, because I'm not a woman. We wanted to look more like a cartoon character, you know, of a woman.
Had you dressed in drag before doing it for movies?
No, I think a couple times on Halloween or something, you know. I was Martha Washington once, I remember.
I'm just going to ask you one question about the famous Pink Flamingo scene in which the movie ends, and just one question about it, and then you have to eat a fresh dog turd, and you and John Waters have both said that you did it to kind of get attention, and the film really did. I mean, you were real upcoming people.
Well, John came to me and he said, well, you know, would you do this? I said, oh, sure. I thought he was kidding. And a year later, he said, okay, now tomorrow you have to eat the dog turd. I thought, oh, this is great. He wasn't kidding, you know. And he said, well, listen, do you want to be famous or do you want to be completely forgotten about? He said, it's going to do either one or the other for you. It's going to make you or forget. You said, but your name will go down in movie history forever anyway, no matter what you do. And I thought, well, what do I care? You know, I was very young, and you don't think about all these things. And I didn't really think about it until I had to follow that dog around for 3 hours. And finally it went, and... it was quite a hideous experience, actually.
Well, here's my question. Did you rush off to an emergency room afterwards?
Well, no, I went
home.
That's
a silly question, but I'd be wondering about, you know, germs and things like
well,
that.
Well, I had mouthwash and things, and I brushed my teeth and goggled. Anyway, I went home, and I was sitting there. And the more I thought about it, then I started to worry. So I called the hospital, and I'll never forget this. And I didn't know what to tell them, you know, because I was a bit old to run around eating dog feces, you know. So I called and I said, oh, hello, this is Mrs. Johnson, and my son just ate dog duty, and what should I do? And she said, well, how old is your son? And I said, well, he's, you know, 24 years old. Well, then the nurse got, she said, some maniac's on the phone here. Her son's 24 and he's eating dogs. So, I got back on the phone. She said, well, why? And I had to tell her, well, I said that he was retarded and that we had a dog and he was in the backyard playing with the dog. The dog had gone to the bathroom and he'd eaten the dog mess, you know. So she said, well, you just have to wash his mouth out and, you know, do all this. She said, but feel his stomach every day because he could get what was called the, you know, like a worm, a white worm. And every day I was feeling my stomach to see if it could. Finally, one day it got hard, and I thought, oh, my God, I've got it. But I had hysterical white worms as it was. I didn't have anything. So I was very lucky. But she suggested that I get rid of the dog.
Well, I know John Waters wants to do a sequel. You wouldn't go through that again for a sequel, would you?
No. I said, didn't want to have to stand under an elephant the next time? Forget it. I said, I had to draw the line somewhere. So I said that was my last experience with animals, please.
The Late Divine, speaking with Terry Gross in 1988. In the Broadway musical Hairspray, Divine's character, Edna Turnblad, is played by Harvey Fierstein. Coming up, we listen to another interview Terry recorded with John Waters 2 years ago. This is Fresh Air. The new musical Hairspray, based on the 1988 John Waters film, opens on Broadway next week. Terry spoke with John Waters in 2000, after his film Cecil B. Demented was released. The film was about a director more extreme than Waters himself, who declares war on mainstream movies and the cineplexes that show them.
Now, did you grow up feeling the same kind of antagonism toward Hollywood that is expressed in this movie?
Because you loved movies. I still love Hollywood. I've always made fun of things I love in my movies. Mm-hmm. When I was growing up, I had never thought I would ever be in Hollywood. I wanted to make, in the beginning, the best underground movie I could make. After that, the best midnight movie I could make. I guess after that, the best, we didn't call them independent movies, but best low-budget movie. And then when I made a Hollywood movie, I tried to make fun of a Hollywood movie. So, and I don't know what I'm making today. It's all those things put together because the movie business is so, there's a real gray area, what's a Hollywood movie and what isn't today. They're the same almost. So, no, I liked Hollywood. We mocked Hollywood in even the star system I had in my early film. I didn't have friends. I wasn't famous. So we thought up these personas, really, of I was the demented director in a way, and Divine was the, you know, my inflated Jane Mansfield. And we even had almost a vaudeville act. When I would show my early movies, we would go to each city, and I would come out looking like a deranged pimp hippie, basically, and introduce the most beautiful woman in the world. And Divine would come out dressed as the Divine character, pushing a shopping cart with dead mackerels in it and throw it in the audience. Then we would hire the cutest hippie in each city, and we had this police outfit that we had stolen, and we would dress him in that on a short-haired wig, and then he'd come out and try to arrest Divine, and Divine would strangle him to death. And that was our act. It was like vaudeville. We did it at midnight shows all the time. So that was the only way we could promote the films. We didn't have any money.
You mentioned that the old theaters in which you used to go see movies aren't really movie theaters anymore. And you have a whole kind of collage of those old movie theaters in Cecil B. Demented. And one of them's a VFW post, and one of them's a big discount store. And so that certainly happened in Philadelphia and some of the theaters, too. Does it break your heart when you see an old movie theater that's now a discount store?
Does it break my heart? I'm not that nostalgic. I think what it is I like them there as ghosts. I hate it when they take the marquee down. I don't mind if it's closed, boarded up, and the marquee gets worse and worse every year and rots and the glass breaks and there's the three letters left are crooked and then there's one letter left. That's kind of fascinating to me.
When you started making movies, there was no independent film circuit. There wasn't a Sundance Film Festival. There wasn't this whole circuit of international film festivals at which you can show independent films. So you had to find places for your movies, and your movies helped create the whole midnight movie circuit.
Well, when I first started, the underground film world I wanted to get into was totally New York-based, and they were very chauvinistic. They wouldn't even look at my movies because I was from Baltimore. And New York was the last place my movie played after I had made Mondo Trasho and Multiple Maniacs. None of them played till after Pink Flamingos became a success in New York. They had played in L.A., San Francisco, Provincetown, Philadelphia. They had played in it. And everywhere but New York. So there was nobody looking for my kind of movie then, believe me. And nobody said they were good, except finally Fran Lebowitz. And one of her first things she ever wrote for Interview Magazine. Nobody liked them. But in those days, they were square critics, so it helped us. We used all the negative reviews. That could never, ever happen today. Even on Serial Mom, I believe, we got two thumbs down, and I wanted to put that in the ad with all the good reviews and two thumbs down. They wouldn't. It can't happen today because all film critics are hip. Nobody's rising to any bait. They're too smart. And in those days when all the critics would say a septic tank explosion, it must be seen, or the most filthy, worst movie ever made, that helped us. That's impossible today. That couldn't happen, and it couldn't help me. Well, if anything, it hurts me because that's my competition. My old movies I bet there'll never be one review of this movie that doesn't mention my old movies in the first paragraph. That happened last time. It happens every time now. Right. So that's okay. They remember my old movies.
Is there anything left of the midnight movie circuit?
No. I don't think to make a midnight movie is suicide, because where would you show it? I mean, I'm sure Rocky Horror still plays somewhere, and people, the last of the cult, still comes in dressed as those outfits. But believe me, those people are not exactly cutting edge.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, but I guess you really couldn't do like the midnight movie thing in the multiplex.
You don't need to, because you play 2, 4, 6, 8, and 10 in a big commercial chain now if you had Rocky Horror.
Right.
Every movie theater is looking for the next Blair Witch, the next Gummo, the next Pink Flamingos. They're looking for the next weirdo movie from nowhere.
Now, is that part of what you mean when you say in your movie, when Cecil B. DeMille says the Hollywood system stole our sex and co-opted our violence, so there's nothing left for us to do?
Well, in a way, that's true, except I think what they really did was end all exploitation. I mean, there's blaxploitation, sexploitation, and violent movies. Once Hollywood made them, those genres were gone. I mean, Shaving Ryan's Privates, that's a porno movie. And I get them mixed up. But Saving, what's the real title? I can't even remember anymore.
Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah. was a gore film, really. Without Herschel Gordon Lewis, we could have never had that. The first 20 minutes were blood feast, basically. It would have been exploitation.
Did you see Shaving Ryan's Privates?
Yes, I saw both. Shaving Ryan's Private spoke to me more.
Did you go to a theater or see it on video?
I saw it on the video, actually. I'm really for people to go to porno theaters. In person, it's for the VCR impaired.
There's
one we shot in Baltimore, the Apex, where the Alicia Witt porno movie is playing. And I was really happy. It's a porno theater at peace with the community. And it's made friends, and there's churches around and everything. It's been there forever. So I was afraid the marquee says an all anal evening, and I was afraid to put the L up until the last minute. I didn't want him to get in trouble with the neighbors, so I just had an all ana evening, and people kept saying, what's that mean? And then just when we did the shot, I put the L in because I didn't want to get him in trouble with the neighbors.
I'm not sure if I've asked you this before or not, but some of the actors and actresses who you've worked with over the years have been very extreme in how they dress and do their hair, and Divine being the best example of that. And you don't fit into that category yourself, at least not now. For example, you're wearing a striped shirt with, you know, a jacket and slacks.
Well, Divine didn't look like Divine in real life either.
Right.
When we were young, we looked like lunatics. We dressed.
Nothing's pierced on your face.
No, nothing's pierced.
No
if
tattoos,
I was young.
No tattoos in sight.
No, I have no tattoos. If I was young, I would have had piercings, I'm sure. Because I had very long hair when I was young, which was the piercings of that day for a man. I'd like piercings. I think the kids look cute with the eyebrow piercing. I tell the parents, don't worry about the piercing. They grow back. It's the tattoos that look bad. No matter how butch, no matter how sexy you are at 20, your tattoos at 50 will make you look very worn out. And somebody's going to make a fortune taking them all off, all these kids. But I think tattoos can look good, especially if you're a convict. It's a good look. Especially if you're released. It is a certain edge it adds to it. But I'm against, like, pretty tattoos. I like ones that are just all black. That's my favorite new one because that really hurts.
But
a solid, big band of all black. That's the kind I like.
Did your parents ever send you to a psychiatrist when you were young?
Yes. Well, they had to. When I was expelled from college, they said he needs extensive psychiatric treatment. They always used to say I needed psychiatric treatment. Yeah, I went. And those shrinks didn't work because I didn't want to go. Later, when I went on my own, it worked. I mean, well, my version of working. My version of mental health, which is what you see here today.
Why did you go on your own?
Well, because I was, like, feeling unhappy about a few things, which I don't usually feel. So it was good, and I went back for a touch-up once.
So when you were sent against your will to the psychiatrist, what was their approach?
Well, the only reason I went was to get out of the Army, because I figured that I was nuts, and this is when they had the draft, and I went through the whole thing. And I would begrudgingly go. And then I got my draft notice, and the shrink said, John, I believe the Army would be the best thing in the world for you.
I thought,
you quack. Right, because I knew I could get out of the Army. It was easy. I said I was gay. I wet my bed. I was a junkie. I checked every single thing, and then the guy said to me, is this true, with this look of disgust on his face? And I, with a casual toss of my long, oily, thin hair, said, yeah. And got sent home. I didn't even have to take the physical. Now, today I know we got to fight for gay rights and we got to join the Army. That's the last place I want to be, is get married or join the Army. I don't get it. Maybe that's how I feel alienated from youth culture. Although, if straight people can have 7 bad marriages, gay people should be allowed at least 1 good one.
Do you know what your next movie is going to be?
Well, and sort of I do, but I haven't written it yet. I'm just beginning. I have notebooks and I have millions of notes and pictures torn out. I want to do a movie that takes place, again, very much in the real blue-collar world about sex addicts and how they deal with their problems in the community. And I think it's going to be called A Dirty Shame because I love that. In Baltimore, people's mothers always used to say, that's a dirty shame what happened to so-and-so. Meaning not that, but just it was an expression I really like. It'd be a great trailer, you know, you show different people and then it's a dirty shame about each one. People in the neighborhood saying, that's a dirty shame what happened to her.
That reminds me of a fake movie title that you use in Cecil B. Demented, which is Some Kind of Happiness.
Yeah.
Where'd you get the title from?
I don't know. I just had to think up like sappy titles of romantic movies. Although I feel that I have some kind of happiness. I think it
what
sounds.
Kind?
I don't know. Some kind. To me, it sounds like a very Douglas Sirk title.
Oh, yeah.
All That Heaven Allows, or that kind of 50s kind of thing, titles that they don't have anymore. Tennessee Williams always had such good titles, you know. I mean, and they don't have those kind of titles that are long, that don't really mean anything, like a, I don't know, like Bus Riley's Back in Town. I mean, there's some great titles, like The Dark at the Top of the Stairs. William Inge had great titles. We don't have those kind of drama titles anymore.
Well, I want to thank you so much, John Waters, for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be back in person with you.
John Waters speaking with Terry Gross 2 years ago. The new Broadway musical Hairspray opens next week. Coming up, a review of the new Clint Eastwood movie, Bloodwork. This is Fresh Air. Clint Eastwood produces, directs, and stars in the new cop thriller Bloodwork. It's adapted from the best-selling novel by Michael Connelly. Movie critic David Edelstein has a review.
In his biography of Clint Eastwood, Richard Schickel pays tribute to what he calls the actor and director's modern jazz manner. He says Eastwood has a, quote, powerful desire, almost amounting to a morality, not to woo the audience, not to make what he does look costly to him, emotionally or intellectually. Now, I think that's true, but Eastwood's manly reticence doesn't always feel like a morality to me. It feels like a big fat limitation. It feels like a fear of commitment. It's also one of the reasons that Eastwood's new thriller, Bloodwork, doesn't have much of a pulse. He plays an ex-FBI profiler named Terry McCaleb, who has just had a heart transplant, and who gets guilt-tripped into trying to track down the guy who shot his organ donor in the head during a convenience store robbery. Now, I know the premise sounds ridiculous, but it works in Michael Connelly's novel. It's even, if you'll forgive me, heartrending. Connelly is one of those modern, hard-boiled writers who have a fetish for forensics and autopsy rooms and a knack for getting into your bloodstream. You get so angry that you don't mind plowing through all that gooey minutiae with the hero. You want the bad guy to go down hard. You want that evil purged. In Bloodwork, the more McCaleb digs into what looked like a routine robbery, the more sickened he becomes at his own unwitting complicity. That murder gave him his heart, which gave him his life. So the evil is inside him. It's literally organic. This is all very creepy, at least in the book. In the movie, it doesn't have the same visceral kick. There aren't enough surprises. There aren't any surprises. I had high hopes when I heard the screenplay was by Brian Helgeland, who co-wrote L.A. Confidential. But Helgeland is almost too smooth a craftsman. He irons out the plot. He takes out the dead ends and the false starts and the red herrings. And there's almost no one left but the killer with a big neon sign that says, "Shoot me before I kill again." Eastwood is supposed to be a whiz-bang serial killer tracker, but the audience is two steps ahead of him the whole time. He comes off as a little thick.
Paper said something you didn't like?
Ballistics will match up this slug with the one in Bolotov's mouth. It was the code killer for all of it. Torres, Cordell, Bolotov, all of them.
What does that mean in English?
I shot the guy right here 2 years ago. The slug in Bolotov's mouth is the one I hit him with. Now I'm back, and so is he.
That rasp of Eastwood's is a bit unsettling. You can almost see the flakes of his vocal cords swirling around his head like dandruff. But the part is a good one for him. He's still as lean as when he played Dirty Harry, but the hoarseness and the barest hint of a daughter give him a rare vulnerability. The performance is touching, and he has a nice banter with Angelica Houston as his raging cardiologist and Tina Lefford as an L.A. detective with whom he has a teasing intimacy. I wish he didn't direct the movie as if his cardiologist had told him to take it easy, though. At the moment when blood work needs to get faster and more tumultuous and more operatic even, it stays laconic. No one expects Eastwood to imitate such hot dogs as Brian De Palma or David Fincher, who made Seven and Panic Room. But what's the point of a gimmicky thriller with no razzle-dazzle, no craftiness? Is that perfunctory climax what Richard Schickel means by morality? Now, I've spent many a happy and amoral beach day with Connolly and Lawrence Block and George P. Pelicanos and Dennis Lehane and other first-rate male and female mystery writers. But the real mystery is why these novels, which combine so much relish of the genre with so much insight into their urban milieus, haven't been turned into killer movies. These writers have taken the stuff of pulp and made it enthrallingly personal. In routine films like Bloodwork, Hollywood is turning it back into pulp.
David Edelstein is the movie critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, looking for the presence of God in a place of great suffering, we talk with Father James Martin. His book, Searching for God at Ground Zero, is a journal of the days he spent among the rescue workers immediately following September 11th. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.